This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. Art and activism are closely intertwined. But how obligated is an artist to address politics or injustice? For Roseanne Cash, that obligation is paramount. She spent 4 decades as an artist, an author, and a Grammy-winning singer-songwriter. And she's also spoken up for causes including copyright protection, fair compensation for songwriters, the Me Too movement, and gun control. Her latest album is called She Remembers Everything, and she joins us from NPR in New York. Roseanne Cash, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you here, and it will be a pleasure to get your questions and thoughts and comments for Roseanne Cash, especially if you are a fan of her music or of her activism, some of her perspectives on some of the issues of the day. So comments on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A or email 1A@WAMU.org. Let's begin with your latest album called She Remembers Everything. It came out in November. Wayne in Florida called us to tell us how much he's been enjoying it. Here's part of what he left in our inbox.
I bought the new album, She Remembers Everything. This is easily one of the best things I've heard all year. It's just fantastic. Every single cut is great. I don't know whether you categorize it as country or pop or songwriter or Americana, but it's the musicianship is just off the charts. It's just fantastic. And I just wanted to congratulate her for, you know, at this stage of her career, just coming out with something so spectacular.
Yeah, Wayne, thanks for calling and sharing your thoughts with us. Tell us a little bit about the album and how it came about, particularly the title, She Remembers Everything.
Well, first, I'm wondering if Wayne does music reviews for a publication. that was very nice. Thank you, Wayne. You know, the last 3 albums I've done were themed records, and some of it was even written in character, and The River and the Thread was about the South, and there were characters in these songs, and I just felt this urgency to return to personal songwriting. I felt that a woman my age, late middle age, still has a lot to say, and a lot less time to say it. And that if I was going to have any regrets, it would be about not really saying what I wanted to say in songwriting without people pleasing, without hedging my bets, without thinking about sales or how it would be received. So that's what I've done. I mean, these songs are full of trauma, sense of mortality, rage couched in compassion, you know, all set to music that that dovetails with all of those themes.
So it sounds like this album was not necessarily a departure skills-wise for you, but that there was a different, like you've reached a turning point in your career and in your life where your focus is a bit different.
It is, and I think that my skill has gotten more refined as a songwriter as time has gone on, and I feel really proud of this, you know, lyrically, like I had achieved something. And it's so exciting to feel that way at my age, like I'm not burnt out, I'm not done, I don't feel irrelevant, and that's thrilling. I'm grateful for that.
Wayne also mentioned that he wasn't sure exactly how to categorize the album. How would you categorize this album, or would you categorize it?
Well, I would stick with Wayne. I wouldn't categorize. You know, I'm a singer-songwriter, so start with that. And I'm embraced, and I embrace the Americana community. So I imagine that's where it fits best.
Well, it really is a remarkable album. We'll play a few tracks a little bit later on. With regards to what did inspire the album, it was also released kind of a year into the Me Too movement. The Nation had been talking about that quite a bit. You recently wrote an op-ed in Billboard magazine reflecting on your experiences as a woman with a lot of experience in the music industry. We'll talk more about that in just a minute, but how much, if at all, did this kind of period of public reckoning, of public upheaval, people rethinking the way that we relate to one another, how much, if at all, did that inspire any of this album?
It did inspire some of it. Some of the songs were written pre-Me Too movement, and oddly, the song She Remembers Everything was written pre-Kavanaugh hearings, which those were really devastating to me. And I look back on that and think, well, that was a little bit prescient, you know. The theme of a woman's memory of trauma and how it stays intact. So I would say that even the some of the songs that were written before that, they were themes that were still resonating to me and still important to me. I have four daughters and a son, so, you know, some of these things are always in the back of my mind.
In your op-ed in Billboard, you speak candidly about your own experiences as an artist, including dealing with sexual harassment. Talk a little bit more about that, particularly breaking into the music industry in your 20s. What was that like?
Well, it was tough. And I, as I said in the Billboard essay, I'm resilient. I have an open heart, but it's matched by a thick skin. So in some ways, I just kept my head down and kept showing up for work. And I was so devoted to becoming a good singer-songwriter, to becoming a great songwriter, that was so important to me that I put up with a lot to get to that. And also, you know, it was a different time back then. A lot of things women just assumed, well, that's what we have to deal with to get forward. You know, men kind of surreptitiously touching inappropriately, saying inappropriate things, suggestive, even rage and violence. I don't know why we put up with it, but a lot of things we did. And I just kept, like I said, I kept blinders on and kept going. And I know some women dropped out. That's really the most heartbreaking thing, is women who gave up what they were most passionate about in this world because they couldn't take that. And I don't pride myself in saying, well, I could take it. I mean, in some ways, I was really lucky. I'm resilient, but I'm also lucky. I guess some things have changed in the music industry since I started in 79, but some things really haven't. I still hear from young women like, I gave up. I couldn't do it.
Were there ever times where you considered giving up?
No. I have an engine that doesn't stop.
You wrote about how common it was in the culture, not just of the music industry generally, but also of being on the road and being on tour specifically, for people to kind of look the other way, to enable bad behavior. There's more light being shed on this practice. And I wonder how you see that going, if there is enough accountability, if it's still not quite enough. Where does that stand for you right now?
Well, you know, I talk about this in the essay, too, is that certainly there's bad behavior by other demographics when they're on the road and away from their home and, you know. But they have a sense that it's wrong, that some kind of shame about it. They hide it. In the music industry, that has been glorified and set to a backbeat and used as a marketing tool. You know, this kind of bad behavior and acting out by men, not so much by women. And that's one reason women felt they had to tolerate it, is that it was used. It was leverage, you know. The bad boys were held up on a pedestal. I do see things changing. There's an initiative out right now called Women in the Mix to try to get more women acknowledged and hired as producers and engineers, because the percentage is abysmal. It's something like less than 5% of producers and engineers are women. So that, trying to create a level playing field for the work, is important. And I see that happening. certainly there's more awareness about sexual harassment and violence and sexism. And I see a lot of different music industry organizations trying to address that and at least become aware of it and see where it's happening. So that is changing. I don't see that a lot of radio programmers or label executives or musicians would act out as they did 20 years ago and feel that they were entitled to it or could get away with it. I think that is changing.
I just looked up real quickly this initiative, Women in the Mix, that you mentioned from the Recording Academy, the organization that puts on the Grammys. And it says that according to Dr. Stacey Smith of the University of Southern California, 2% of pop music producers and 3% of engineers and mixers in pop music are women. So very low figures.
Low, yeah, way less than 5%. I mean, it's infuriating, but it's also heartbreaking. I mean, just think of what we're missing, the gifts that women could bring that they can't get in the door. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, the initiative says that it's asking for every time a music producer or engineer is hired, that at least two women are identified and considered, kind of a Rooney rule for hiring in music. Do you think this is partly a pipeline issue? Like, I wonder who is encouraging women to be music producers or engineers or mixers as opposed to artists.
Yeah, I don't think anybody was encouraging that. Do you know, in almost 40 years of recording, I think that I've come across maybe two women in the studio who were second engineers and zero women who were the chief engineer. So it just was, there was no pipeline for women. They had to, in the same way they had to carve it out as a doctor, you know, at the early part of the century or mid-century. That's just starting to happen.
We are speaking to Roseanne Cash. Her latest album is called She Remembers Everything. Welcome your questions, thoughts, stories about seeing Roseanne, any of her music that impacted you, or any questions you might have. 1A@WAMU.org. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. I want to move on and talk a little bit about some of the other issues that you've been outspoken on, but just to kind of wrap this up, is there anything else that you would want to see more artists, more industry insiders do to hold themselves accountable in the future for some of the behaviors that have made it hard for women to ascend in the industry?
You know, one thing I've thought a lot about is after the huge blow up in the Time's Up campaign in the film industry, I read an op-ed that said there's no reason that a movie producer should ever meet a woman alone in a hotel room, that there were conference rooms, that, you know, that just shouldn't happen. And I kept thinking about that. Is there a corollary in the music industry where a woman would not be put in a vulnerable position? And I couldn't really think of one, but that kind of strategizing might make sense. You know what I mean? I mean, I know I found myself on a tour bus with all men hundreds of times, and they were generally very respectful, but man, I did turn a blind eye to behavior that would have ended every relationship they had back home. I don't know how to answer your question. I'm observing and at the same time trying to speak more openly myself. I thought it was time to talk about these things, which is why I wrote my own, the essay for Billboard. And partly, Joshua, partly the reason I felt it was time for me to write about it is that it's been put to rest in myself. And I thought it would be helpful.
What do you mean put to rest in yourself?
Well, that I'm not still traumatized by those things that happened to me. I hate the word process, but I'll use that word. I've processed it.
Before we move on to some of your other advocacy, I wonder if maybe these days it's a little different because of technology. You know, the music industry has kind of been blown up, and people can be their own publishers and their own, you know, record labels if they want to be. How much has that made a difference in all of this?
Yeah, they call that going sovereign. Sure, it's made a difference if you've got autonomy and you're not at the mercy of a label executive and a recording studio and engineer. If you're doing everything on your own, yeah, there's more protection and more autonomy. at the same time, it's a community. And I think the community is getting aired out, and that we don't have to sacrifice each other's creativity by these old models, and that this creative fire that musicians have doesn't have to incinerate one half of the community.
Glad to hear from some of your fans as well. Kimberly wrote on our Facebook page, "I just love her to know that she's meant so much to me, not only as a wife of a full-time, independent, nationally touring musician who I have to share with his fans, but also as a songwriter in my own right. Thank you for your music. Thank you for your words. Thank you for your voice." Susan emailed, "I saw Roseanne in January at a music festival. I was so excited she was a headliner and already loved her music. I had heard the Eight Gods of Harlem on Sirius XM radio on the country station. So powerful. Thank you, Roseanne Cash, for the awesome music." I want to talk to you more about your process when we continue, but it must be tremendously heartening to hear about fans, including some new fans who are kind of turned on to some of your newer work.
It's so heartening. I do not take any of that for granted. I am really grateful.
Is this kind of where you saw yourself at this point in your career?
You know, that is half the community, is the audience. We're not doing this out of pure narcissism, you know. It's a dialogue and a chemistry exchange with the audience. Is that where I saw myself now? I'm not very good at five-year plans or envisioning the future. I never have been. I've always been kind of put my next foot forward, you know, where is it leading me? Where is the inspiration? I can say I couldn't have imagined that I would still feel so passionate and so grateful. I'm really lucky.
I want to hear a little bit of one of the tracks from She Remembers Everything as we pause our conversation with Roseanne Cash. When we return, let's talk a little bit more about some of your other advocacy, including relating to gun laws. But this is The Undiscovered Country from the new album She Remembers Everything. We'll get to some more of your questions and comments in just a moment. Stay close.
Mothers and the kings, Shakespeare and my father, who kicked dust up in my dreams. If you too close.
Back now to our conversation with Roseanne Cash. Her new album is called She Remembers Everything. We'll get to some more of your questions and comments in a moment. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@wamu.org. Advocating for protection from sexual harassment in the music business is just one cause that you've raised your voice for. You've also been very active on gun control issues for years. And in 2017, you wrote a New York Times op-ed urging country musicians to stand up to the National Rifle Association, to the NRA. When did that issue land on your radar as something you wanted to be vocal about?
Columbine. One of my daughters was a teenager then, and we were watching it unfold on the news, and I said to her in shock, I said, "How did these kids get the guns?" And she looked at me like I was crazy, and she said, "Mom, I could buy a gun easier than I can buy cigarettes." And I got involved right then. I was on the board of an organization. I went to the Million Mile March. I wrote an op-ed for Rolling Stone then, and I've stayed involved in activism against gun control for 20 years now.
If I recall from one of the op-eds that you wrote, you noted that you left one organization because you got tired of meeting grieving parents over and over and over, just this kind of litany of woe that never seemed to really get better, that there wasn't any traction. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah. I hate to say I got tired of it because it seems so callous, but I did feel this burden, like I had to put my energy, stay with the cause, but put it elsewhere because it's so painful and hard to meet these parents over and over and see nothing change. It was so dispiriting. And I haven't dropped out of the cause by any means, but I have been focused elsewhere.
Now, you called out country artists and American roots music artists specifically and encouraged them, in your view, to kind of end their silence and to disavow the NRA. Why those genres?
Well, because I had seen that the NRA was very pernicious about trying to equate patriotism, which a lot of country musicians are known for, with guns. And it was infuriating because patriotism does not equal guns and, you know, this kind of blind adherence to what I consider a misinterpretation of the Second Amendment. And so that's what I was talking about, is that I consider myself a patriot. I belong to the Daughters of the American Revolution. I'm seriously patriotic, and yet I'm all for gun control.
That must be an interesting, at times, uphill conversation in some parts of the country music business. I mean, I remember when the Dixie Chicks were outspoken politically and were kind of dragged for it for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, conversation being a questionable word, there's not much conversation. I don't see a lot of dialogue. Although I got a letter from a young man after the Las Vegas shooting and after he read my op-ed in the Times and said, I've changed my mind. I saw what happened and I've changed my mind. And I was respectful and heartened by that. But, you know, I haven't been embraced by the straight country community in a long time, so it's not like I'm inside the game trying to stir things up. I'm very much outside that community. But I feel connected to it, obviously, and have love for many people there and friendships. And I just don't feel like I can be silent about this. It's an extension of parenting.
Does that give you, in terms of your outsider status, I was going to ask you about that status, that outsider status, also the fact, you know, just to be blunt, that, you know, you are the daughter of Johnny Cash, and I imagine that changes the way that people interact with you on a lot of levels.
Yeah, these people who are against what I say, they use my dad as a weapon against me. You know, your dad would be so ashamed of you. Well,
ashamed of
really?
You?
Yeah, for yeah. I mean, my dad becomes a cipher sometimes. People project onto him their own agendas. It's just it's kind of shocking. I've seen it happen my whole life. But I mean, also, I don't use him back. Ever. I do not use him as a weapon back to them. But the truth is that he was on the advisory board of the first organization I belonged to to protect children from gun violence. He was a pragmatist and a almost Quaker in his nonviolence. And, you know, we felt the same about that.
What do you find are some of the other things that people kind of project onto Johnny Cash that may or may not match the man that you knew?
Oh, his, you know, deep conservatism, which he was not, and his I don't know, because I don't project anything onto him.
You knew the guy.
I actually knew him. I mean, it's but also, I don't project things onto Johnny Cash. Do you know what I mean? I had a relationship with my father. It didn't go into another realm of icon status. You know what I mean?
Was there ever a point for you when it kind of, for lack of a better word, kind of clicked, kind of settled in for you that my dad is capital J, capital C Johnny Cash?
Oh, as a child, you know, I was aware of the level of his fame, and but he always kept it real with his kids, so we kept it real back.
David wrote on our Facebook page, "I greatly appreciate the By Degrees song and fundraiser for Gabby Giffords' Courage to Fight Gun Violence organization. Your voice on this song was very moving, as were the other singers. How did you get involved in that project?"
Yeah, I'm very proud of being on that song. It was written by a singer-songwriter, Mark Arelli, who's in Boston and who has been very active in anti-gun violence as well. And he asked me and Sheryl Crow and Josh Ritter and a few other singers to each take a verse on this song about gun violence. And we did. And then he gave the song to the Gabby Giffords organization. So a download equals a donation to her. And I thought it was just a beautiful thing.
Let's hear a little piece of that song now. This is By Degrees.
When I take a look around me, sometimes I wish I was blind. Feels like something sacred's dying, one headline at a time. I can't tear myself away, no, I just stare in disbelief. You can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees.
I've seen every head bowed down as if lost in private prayer. I've seen the phones in every hand, seen the long and vacant stares of souls gone numb, thumbing through each ceaseless change and fear. You can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees.
I've seen talking heads shout back and forth across some great divide, against a map of red and blue, points of view so cut and dry. But when you look into the mirror, what color country do you see? Well, you can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees. I've seen the flags that have staff as the nation mourned and moaned. I've seen the stars and bars of flying bright above the State House dome for the Charleston Nine. We sing, I once was blind, but now I see. We can learn to live with anything when it happens by degrees.
Those were Roseanne Cash, Josh Ritter, Lori McKenna, and Sheryl Crow, all singing on By Degrees. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Deborah emailed, "Your album 7 Year Ache became the soundtrack for a painful time in my life. You gave voice to my heartbreak and gave me the strength to walk away from an unhappy marriage. I am forever grateful." Tell us about that album, 7 Year Ache. Yeah, yeah.
That was my second album in the States. I had made one in Europe before that that just kind of died a instant death, which was actually a good thing. But I think that that's when I felt I broke through as a songwriter. And I was 24 years old and didn't know what I was doing. Sometimes I sing that song in concert now and I think, how did that young girl write that song? But there were some raw moments on that record. That means a lot to me that she says that it gave her strength to leave an unhappy marriage. You know what's interesting is that when you write songs and you don't know what it's going to mean to your audience, you know what it means to you, but that's why I hesitate to say what songs are about and take away someone else's interpretation.
Yeah, because you kind of never know how it's going to, what
know.
It's going to do for somebody.
You hope it does something, that they bring their own life and their own feelings to it and leave it open for their own, how they're going to use it in their own psyche.
How has your songwriting process changed over the years? You say you look back at that, at the 20-something gal who wrote that, compared to who you are now. How has that process evolved for you?
I'm not so worried that it's going to go away. You know, early on, every time I would write something that I thought was good, I'd think, well, that's it. Never going to write another song again. And then eventually it would come back. You know, I had this fear that I had a quota at birth. I don't think like that anymore. So that's changed for me. And I have more confidence in not spelling things out and leaving more ambiguity in the lyrics. And I'm more comfortable with collaboration, too. I collaborate a lot with my husband, John Leventhal, and he's not a lyric writer, and so he writes the music, I write the lyrics when we collaborate, and I've learned to enjoy not being territorial about my songs.
Territorial?
Yeah, like, oh, I have to write everything, you know, it has to be exactly, every moment has to be my own expression. Well, when he writes the music, he brings his self to it, and I benefit from his gifts, you know, and I'm happy to do that.
What was it that allowed you to open yourself up to that?
I think maturity and lack of fear, you know. Like, I want to create good work in the world, and I enjoy collaboration to achieve that sometimes.
Suzanne wrote, as lovers of live music performances, my husband and I treated ourselves to a trip to New York to hear Roseanne at Carnegie Hall. It is an indelibly magnificent memory. What about as a live performer? How do you feel that you've evolved and matured over time?
Ah, that is more clear to me. I used to think that live performance, being on a stage, was a place where you went to be judged. And so I would take my fear and trepidation to the stage. And I've realized, it's been a while since I realized this, that it's not about that at all. It's about energy exchange and creating something temporal with an audience for that evening, and about awakening something in me and in them. You know, Bob Dylan said this great thing I read, that he said, the audience doesn't come to see you to know what your feelings are. They come to know what their own feelings are. And, you know, that the function of art to reveal us to ourselves and spark something and change something. And I've come to realize that that's a shared experience. In a concert. It's not just about me.
Maybe to the point you just made, by way of ending our conversation, let me read one last email. Julia writes, my mother was one of her father's biggest fans. My mom died in November 2014 at 55 years old, 2 months short of me being able to take her to see Roseanne Cash at Cincinnati's Music Hall. I didn't want to go without my mom, but as I sat and wept quietly that evening, I felt like Ms. Cash was speaking straight to me. She sang her father's song, I Still Miss Someone. Roseanne Cash's new album is called She Remembers Everything. Roseanne, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
As we conclude with her track, The Only Thing Worth Fighting For, I should note this conversation was produced by Stacia Brown. To learn more about her and the rest of our team, visit the1a.org/staff. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A. Inside the sun.